Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So yesterday, I went to the Sudhana Center. It's associated with Dharma Realm Buddhist University, and the university students and teachers and staff were gathered there. For 3 days, Ajahn Yaniko did the first day, Ajahn Kurundamo did the second day, I did the third day, and they were having a 3-day retreat on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And so of course that theme is still running through my mind, and it's a worthy theme to bring to attention and to reflect on, as these four foundations of mindfulness are quite central to the Buddha's teaching and to the Buddha's path of practice in the discourse itself. The Buddha gives a strong statement, saying that it's these four foundations are a teaching or practice that leads in one way only, and that's to the ending of suffering, to full liberation, and that. Recollection or that reflection something that is rare, that the Buddha is so emphatic. And with the teaching itself, the Buddha is just taking what is quite ordinary, but making it conscious as an object of attention and awareness. So the body itself, the feelings, and feelings in a sense is a much more of a fundamental sense in that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the mind, and then the dhammas, or it's like phenomena, mind objects, so different categories of attention within the mind to be observant of. So this the taking or lifting up of the body in different ways. The mindfulness of the elements, in a sense, looking at the body as its fundamental elements, sometimes in terms of its, so like I would say, just in terms of the element of solidity, the element of fluidity, the element of heat, the element of expansion and contraction, or the air element. That's a helpful way of viewing the body in a way that doesn't keep reaffirming our identity and identification that we so tend to have. Reflecting in terms of just mindfulness and clear comprehension, and really having a grounded awareness in our, as we change postures, as we move, as we engage, as we speak, as we don't speak, just really being able to have that continuity of mindfulness and clear comprehension as a foundation, but using the body as a base. Recollecting in terms of the just the parts of the body. That sense of what we call body is just a collection of parts, various bits and pieces that we call ourselves: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, internal organs, fluids, and having that sense of reflecting on the body in a way where, because so much of the, say the, you know, the Buddhist teachings are trying to get us to take a look at both internal, external phenomena in a way that allows us to not keep recreating that sense of I and me and mine. There's that identification is so strong, but it's something that the Buddha just points to as this is something that we are doing. It's not something that's inherent. In the actual scriptural language, the I making, this ahankara, so the I making is it's something that we're doing, we're engaging in, and it's a habitual process that we invest in. So we I making, the mind making, this is mine, and then the underlying tendency to conceit, and that, and the Buddha uses, and sometimes the language is it's hard to get equivalents. But the word that is translated as conceit in from the scriptural language is a because in English when we think of conceit, then it's sort of like having a elevating, lifting oneself up, or looking down on somebody, and there's a conceit. But from the Buddhist perspective, there's the sense of conceit is one of viewing oneself through comparison, say either comparing oneself to others, and in terms of being inferior or equal or superior, really doesn't matter. And in whether it's true or not true, it's still this habit, that habit of comparing, and that's where this sense of what the Buddha calls conceit. So our continual tendency to compare ourselves to others and then evaluate and either come up short or take a stand of being the same as, or lifting oneself up. And But that eye making, the mind making, the underlying tendency to conceit, and so when we reflect on the on the mind, of course it's the mind that's doing it, but sometimes the mind is just so hard to get a handle on. Tsegajan Cha emphasizing, you know, be careful of the mind. It's a liar and it's a cheat. And it does. It has this, we fall for it fairly frequently. I think one of the times Ajahn Chah said, well, it's not that we fall for the the way that the mind deceives us, like a fish taking the bait and that's on a hook for a fisherman catching fish. So it's not like that, because the fish only gets it caught in the mouth. We tend to get it caught like a frog. We just glom onto it and swallow it right down. It's very stark images. And so that's why the mindfulness of the body is really helpful, because it provides a really good mirror for what the mind is doing. Because sometimes that direct investigation of the mind one needs to have a pretty sharp degree of mindfulness and discernment, and then the body is a good anchor. It's solid. It's present, and as is oftentimes said, it's like the body is at least is always in the present moment. As soon as you pay attention to the body, you're back in the present moment, and that's really helpful. And then it's a bit more, say the changes are reasonably discernible. And as well as a kind of a motivation to learn how to understand the nature of existence or the nature of this human condition. When we reflect on the body, there's what is apparent is it's subject to old age, sickness, death. There's just an article in the, or like a scientific article that was published recently, where the body has a, or the human condition, the human mind, the brain, we're kind of hardwired to disregard death. Helpfully in some cases, in a lot of cases, but it does tend to the way that the mind actually identifies and perceives itself. They've done some experiments of having faces of, or say like the, you, in the experiment, you have faces of yourself, faces of others, and then there's different words associated, and when we, and then of course they're hooked up to MRI machines, and the areas of the brain where there's the association with self, with with oneself, then once the words that are associated with other aspects of experience, it empathizes, it sees with itself, when it sees with others, it's discerning, it's something to do with others. But then when there's the words associated, say, with death, with funeral, with then, and the figure, the image is ourselves, then it skips over it. It doesn't respond. I just didn't see that, don't know anything about it. So it's a great, I think probably a confirmation of what we all experience ourselves and intuit, I know it's something that happens, yeah, other people, not me. But contemplation of the body is really, and that is one of the contemplations, and that those contemplation of death, charnagram contemplations, and then the mindfulness of breathing is a contemplation of the body. But then that's its own practice really, because it does incorporate all the different aspects of the four foundations of mindfulness, and that. But those contemplations of those foundations of mindfulness are very helpful in terms of settling, calming, bringing about a quality of stillness and clarity. But then also having themes for contemplation, for the mind to contemplate, to investigate, to create a discernment that has a deep understanding of the nature of our experience, so that we're, because it's the ability to not identify, not cling to experience, not the shutting, pushing it away, shutting it out, ignoring. It's being able to bring it into the heart completely and to be able to release it back. It's like the contemplations of the elements, and you realize, well, that everything that is around us in the world is a manifestation of these fundamental elements. It's like the earth element, fire element, water element, air element, element of space, element of consciousness. These are fundamental elements, and that's what constitutes the whole. But it's what constitutes what we call me and my, this life, this form. But it's going according to, in the same way that nature outside of us is following its own patterns, following its own fundamental patterns. The same thing for us. And these are following these patterns of cause and condition. They arise, they establish themselves for a while, and they cease. And there's this constant arising and ceasing. So that having the clarity and the stillness that allows one to witness that, and to not get entangled in the identification. So there's a quality of peace and a freedom of heart that that is able to arise with that. So that contemplation of the body, contemplation of feeling, in the same way that that's as a mental experience, every mind moment has a certain feeling tone, the feeling tone of pleasant, of the unpleasant, and of neutral, and to be able to say to look at things rather than going up and down and following the quality of that, you're looking more at what's the feeling tone under that. Also, it tends to like the movement of mind. It tends to correspond to the actual feeling tone that's there. We tend to something that's pleasant. We tend to take interest, get excited. There's a certain kind of movement toward it with desire. With something that's unpleasant, we tend to pull back from it with either aversion or dislike in some way. With the neutral, we tend to either get dull with it or confused, uncertain, because it's not manifesting anything so clearly. So that being able to use feeling as a doorway for understanding how to establish a continuity of clarity and discernment, rather than this constant reaction to the tone of the feeling that we do experience, and that so that's a foundation of mindfulness, or a doorway for investigating experience. So we're taking these different experience which of within our human condition or human life, and then training ourselves to investigate it from different perspectives, and to understand it in a not just in a superficial way, but in a much deeper way, and of course it does have this that goal that the Buddha says over and over again. It's right for the basis of his teaching is to understand that the way in which we create discontent, dissatisfaction, stress, suffering, and to free ourselves from that, and so that with our experience of body and mind, and that's how we say experience the world. Because when we say world, oftentimes we objectify it outside. Okay, there's the world out there, and then there's me. There's a separateness. But then the Buddha is saying, well, you know, when he's asked what the world is, you know, so he said, well, that whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that is the world. Because we're the avenue, or the mediator, that's where we experience. That's how we. That's what the experience is. through the perception and the perceiving and the conceiving. The aspects of mind are being able to just tune into to the, because there isn't a, the Buddha doesn't idealize how our mind should be. What he does is points to what trying to getting us to look, especially with these foundations of mindfulness, trying to get us to understand what we are experiencing, what is the mind. And mind with greed or desire, knowing the mind with the greed as a mind with greed or desire, when it's without greed and desire, to know it as a mind without greed and desire. It's a mind with aversion or ill will. To know that as a mind with aversion or ill will. When it's not that, when there's not any aversion or ill will, to know that with the mind that is overcome by delusion, or when delusion is not there, mind that is, say, contracted, the mind that's expansive, the mind that is still, the mind that is agitated, and then also knowing the mind that is liberated. And what is it? What is the mind that is liberated? So it's an exploration of the experience of this human condition, and paying attention to it. I remember one time. when I was in, I did a period of about a year retreat in Thailand, and be about 10 years or something like ago, something like that, 10 or so years ago, and was in solitude for almost all that time, and had a very, there's a lot of continuity in the practice. And I had the opportunity to go pay respects to Ajahn Mahabua, who's highly regarded, highly revered as and considered as fully awakened by many, many people. And when I went to see him, he'd have been in his early 90s. And it was quite wonderful because he gave me a time to be with him on his own. There was a few of us monks went along, but he wasn't, because generally whenever he went anywhere there'd be huge crowds of people. but he gave me time to meet at his kuti, and we were talking and we're just getting some guidance, and I was asking for, just letting him know what my practice was doing and what guidance he would suggest. And he immediately honed in on the, just coming back to just that just purifying the mindfulness, keeping it simple, keeping it straightforward, purifying the mindfulness, purifying this awareness. And then using, of course, using the four foundations of mindfulness, but not so much that it's method-oriented or technique-oriented, but enough of an object of attention so that the quality of awareness and knowing is able to stand out. And that's where the heart is able to free itself. So that that sense of again, as I mentioned, the using the one uses all the four foundations of mindfulness in that way, but particularly the body is this having an anchor where one can use it as a mirror to see what the mind is doing, seeing where the mind is moving, and then how can I release that? How can I allow that? That awareness, that quality of knowing, to shine forth. And so these four foundations of mindfulness are really important basis of the whole training in the Buddha's teachings. And then the last, category or the phenomena, dhamma, mindfulness of dhammas, and it's a bit of a loose definition, but it's what in terms of the mind or in terms of practice and reflection, so that paying attention to the five hindrances. Okay, what are the obstacles that are coming up? What are the habit patterns that of the mind that are problematic? Which is, of course, the Buddha defines and fundamentally, that tendency to sensual gratification, tendency to ill will, tendency to say to drowsiness or dullness, shutting off, or tendency to restlessness and worry, that the mind is churning, moving, or the tendency to doubt and uncertainty. Those are habits of mind that are, the Buddha said, this is an obstacle, this is a hindrance to development. The paying attention to the qualities of mind that are really supportive for the liberation of the heart. It's that the seven factors of awakening. So mindfulness, of course, it's really making that explicit. Mindfulness, investigation of truth, effort or energy, joy or delight, rapture, tranquility, a settling of the body and the mind. Samadhi, the stilling or the firm establishing of the mind, where it starts to become more unshakable, steady, and then equanimity, where it's seeing things through, it's able to hold whatever experience is there. It's held in this quality of steadiness and unshakability. It's equanimous. It's seeing, it's recognizing, it's understanding. It's not pushing anything away. It's not chasing after anything. It is steady. I think that was one of the tea time. There was a question of my association with Ajahn Chah, or my meeting of Ajahn Chah, and that was one of the things that I saw over and over again. That was really inspiring. Here was somebody, human being, who was in the midst of activity, engagement, people came to him with all their problems, the community was sometimes less than ideal, and never ever saw him shaken by anything. He was always equanimous, not in the sense of not feeling, not seeing, not or pushing stuff away, but not shaken by anything. And not only not shaken, I mean, he'd have a great sense of humor about it, really not. Okay, human beings are doing what human beings are doing. This is not new. And that sense of being present, and being present for everybody. There were so many people were drawn to him of so many different backgrounds and different statuses within the culture. I mean, it was whether people were educated, not educated, whether they were wealthy, whether they were poor, whether they were from sort of northeast Thailand or from the other areas of Thailand, or whether they're from foreign countries. He was in the midst of that and not sort of shaken. So that quality of equanimity is a part of, as a factor of awakening. So then that these different categories of what are called the Dham Anupassana Satipatthana, the foundation of mindfulness in regards to contemplation of phenomena. Take a lens of the hindrances, take a lens of these incredibly positive, wholesome qualities to view our experience through and to work with. On a sort of neutral level, they're looking at through the categories of the khandhas, body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, through the six sense bases, just seeing it as sense phenomena, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental objects. I mean, because we tend to get caught up in stories, whether it's our own story, somebody else's story, story of the world. We love stories. I mean, who doesn't like a good story? But those stories can just keep going on and on. Being able to say, that's just sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental object. There's a simplification there that is, again, it's not just dismissive, but it's like, that's all that's going on. And then, of course, the other category that the Buddha encourages in terms of investigation is the Four Noble Truths, and that's looking at things from an experiential level. What are we experiencing? Are we experiencing something that is making us peaceful, or is it something that's making us agitated? What are we contributing? If it's making us agitated or dissatisfied, how are we contributing to that? If it's something that's creating peace, a settling of the that experience of say discontent, moving to how do we support that? How do we give attention to that? How do we make much of it? How is it sustainable? So it's an exploration. So these teachings are, and the tools that the Buddha is giving us are tools. It's learning how to use the tools, learning how to. The teachings that we have is really learning how to become skillful in the use of those tools. It's like recently, I've been, of course, been away for quite some time, and one of the things I did recently, I went and took a look at the workshop, and we got a lot of tools, and I started looking at it, and it's well set up. It's really nicely looked after. It's nice and clean and neat and tidy. That's really wonderful to see. But so for myself, I said, I haven't got a clue how to use most of those tools there. I have to rely on others who have the knowledge. Those tools for cultivation of peace and discernment that the Buddha's given us. I'm more familiar with that. That's something to be. Whatever tool it is, we have to learn how to use it, develop the skill with it, and understand where its possibilities. So with these teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness, it really is a foundational teaching and one that the Buddha returned to over and over again, and also one that he actually said if he taught on the four foundations of mindfulness and continued to teach except for breaks for eating, for dealing with bodily functions, for sleeping, resting. He could keep teaching until he died and still not exhaust the possibilities. So for ourselves to lift them up, investigate them, learn how to use them, and explore their application. Does, as the Buddha says, this is what leads to the overcoming of suffering, the purification of beings. To offer that for reflection this evening.
Close at the verse.